This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, March 31st, 2014. I'm Yitzhak Winnecker-Hayda. Ozarks at Large is supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, a preview of an upcoming grief seminar for bereaved parents. Also, Fort Smith releases its annual point-in-time count of homeless people in the community. Those stories and more, but first, the latest numbers from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics released Friday show improvement to Arkansas's unemployment rate. The seasonally adjusted jobless rate dropped from 7.3% in January to 7.1% in February. Michael Packow with UALR's Institute for Economic Advancement says the data is showing a trend with other recent reports.
This was the sixth consecutive month that we've seen those underlying statistics move in the right direction. So it was a fairly positive report overall, particularly when it comes to the household employment statistics.
Packow says the latest report shows evidence of improvement in one of Arkansas's most important economic sectors.
We've been seeing some general weakness in the goods-producing sectors, manufacturing and construction, in recent years. Those have been the areas that have been slow to recover from the recession. But the good news is that over the first couple of months of 2014, we've seen some pretty substantial gains in those areas.
While moving closer to the national unemployment rate, Arkansas still lags 0.4 of a percentage point behind. The CEO of Little Rock-based Axiom Corporation says he supports stronger regulations on companies that collect, analyze, and market consumer data. In a presentation to investors associated with Delta Trust and Bank last week, Scott Howe, Axiom CEO, said the use of collected consumer data should be limited to marketing purposes only. He said consumers should also have the right to deny access to companies that want to collect their personal data.
In every interview I have done in the last year, when I talk to 60 Minutes, when I talk to CNN, when I talk to the New York Times, when I talk to the Wall Street Journal, when I talk to Senator Rockefeller, I always say the same thing, which is, you might be surprised to know that Axiom is in favor of much stronger privacy regulation.
Axiom has recently come under increased scrutiny by national media and the U.S. Senate Commerce Committee, chaired by Senator Jay Rockefeller of New York, for the extent of its consumer data collections. Last year, Axiom opened a website, aboutthedata.com, which allows users to see what information the company has collected about them. Those seeking public records in Washington County can again access records from before 2009 via the Internet. Kyle Sylvester, Washington County Circuit Clerk, says the documents were removed from the web in September in accordance with an administrative order by the state Supreme Court last June.
Back in 2009, they made it where anything that was available via a search engine on the Internet, those documents with all the personal information such as Social Security numbers, account numbers, especially like juvenile cases with birthdays and stuff like that, all that information had to be redacted. Of course, juvenile cases really aren't available online, but everything that had those type of things in there had to be redacted or blotted out.
As documents after 2009 were already being redacted as per the order to put records online, the Arkansas Supreme Court issued Administrative Order 19, which stated that all pre-2009 records had to be pulled from the web until they were redacted. Sylvester says that the county had roughly 750,000 documents to redact to be in accordance with the court order. But instead of going through all of those documents and making redactions by hand, he says his office instead used a computerized option.
The court management system that we have, the software company, is called COT Systems, and they're out of Ohio. What they did is they developed a small program to go in and identify Social Security numbers, account numbers, and things like that, and automatically redact those.
Sylvester says the redaction process took a little longer than originally expected, and that the pre-2009 records were unavailable for roughly 6 months from September to late February. But now, all records are back online and can be accessed for free on the county's website, co.washington.ar.us. The College of Engineering at the University of Arkansas has received a sizable gift commitment to support a teaching endowment. According to the college, alumnus Robert Bigadike has made an estate commitment valued at more than $7.8 million, which will in turn be used to establish a teaching endowment in his name in the college. Bigadike received his bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering from the U of A in 1958 and later returned to the campus to receive his master's degree. The Razorback baseball team didn't find luck on the road over the weekend. Though Arkansas shut out Mississippi State 4-0 in the first game of Saturday's doubleheader, the Hogs lost the second game Saturday and again dropped yesterday's decision with a final score of 5-1 in both lost games. After the three games, Arkansas is now 17-10 on the season and 4-5 in SEC play. The Razorbacks return home tomorrow for a two-game set against Nebraska. The next head coach of Arkansas women's basketball has been selected. The UA Athletics Department has announced that Jimmy Dykes, a coach and former ESPN analyst, has been named the 8th head coach of women's basketball. Dykes has previously coached at the U of A, Sacramento State University, Appalachian State, the University of Kentucky, the U of A in Little Rock, and at Oklahoma State University. He also spent 2 seasons working as a college scout for the Seattle Supersonics before working for ESPN. Tonight's weather forecast calls for mostly cloudy conditions with a 30% chance of showers and a low of 46 in northwest Arkansas, and a 20% chance of showers and a low of 52 in the Arkansas River Valley. Mostly cloudy tomorrow with a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms and highs from 71 to 77. Mostly cloudy tomorrow night with a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms with lows from 57 to 60. This is Ozarks at Large. There is new news on the Mayflower oil spill, and Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas has the details in his weekly business and political news update.
On the one-year anniversary of a ruptured pipeline, ExxonMobil representatives told a Mayflower audience this past week that environmental progress has been made. The Pegasus pipeline burst on May 29th, 1 year ago, spilling crude oil and contaminating a Mayflower subdivision. Karen Tyrone, vice president for ExxonMobil Pipeline Company, tells me that the company is submitting a remediation plan to federal regulators that will include extraordinary integrity testing measures that may take more than a year to complete. The oil and gas giant has also discovered additional factors that may have caused the pipeline to rupture beyond just the manufacturing defect earlier stated as a cause. Pine Bluff-based Simmons First National Corporation will acquire Little Rock-based Delta Trust and Bank for roughly $66 million. The transaction is the second in less than a year for Simmons First, which acquired Little Rock-based Metropolitan National Bank in September 2013 for more than $53 million. Combined personal incomes in Arkansas during 2013 grew 2.2%, below the 2.6% U.S. average, with the state's per capita average of $36,086 pushing Arkansas's national ranking from 45th in 2012 to 46th in 2013. Walmart executives keenly focused on improving comparable sales and driving top-line revenue are testing a new Savings Catcher pricing tool as a way to drive in-store traffic and hammer home their low-price message. The program only pertains to groceries, and it allows a Walmart customer to enter a number from the bottom of his receipt into the Walmart website. The system then analyzes all grocery advertisements in the area, and if other retailers had a lower price, the difference is credited to the shopper on a Walmart gift card. A journalist who sparked a wave of negative publicity for Bill and Hillary Clinton in the 1990s shared his cautionary tale of fostering Clinton hating and his conversion to supporting the Clintons, including a 2016 potential presidential run by Hillary Clinton. David Brock, who once wrote stories that included scandals involving Paula Jones and Arkansas State Troopers for the conservative magazine The American Spectator, said he was duped by right-wing opponents of the Clintons into writing stories he later discovered should have been discredited. Republican gubernatorial candidate Curtis Coleman rolled out a tax cut and regulatory reduction plan that he said would benefit mom-and-pop businesses, encourage more military retirees to the state, and stoke economic investment in depressed parts of Arkansas. Coleman said his plan, which would eventually cost about $2.3 billion, would drop unemployment below 5%, add 100,000 new jobs to the state, and result in a 20% reduction in the number of Arkansans living below the poverty level. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business and Politics update.
Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T, encouraging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com. In January, the Old Fort Homeless Coalition held its annual point-in-time count of sheltered and unsheltered homeless people in the community. The count was then sent to the State Office of Housing and Urban Development in Little Rock for processing. The official numbers were released last week. Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas spoke with one of the key members in the Old Fort Homeless Coalition and has this report about Fort Smith's 2014 point-in-time count.
Overall, the number of homeless decreased from last year and is at its lowest point in 4 years, though the number for those left without shelter increased. Debbie Everly is the director of homeless programs for the Old Fort Homeless Coalition. She says it was a cold night in January when the committee tasked with surveying the homeless set out to ask their questions.
We have people who, on an extremely cold night, will try to seek some shelter. They may go in with somebody or four people and get a room at the Garden Inn or, try to find somebody's couch that they could sleep on. So those people we definitely would miss during that count. So the weather does affect it a little bit. Basically, we're still seeing the unsheltered count. It rose slightly this year, and that's why we still think that we need the Riverview Hope campus, because of the number of unsheltered people, because those are the people that we will be providing shelter for.
And so what is that number for this year, for the unsheltered?
This year, I think it was 72.
For the
72
unsheltered?
72 for the unsheltered. And I think last year they had 68, mm-hmm. I recall.
And so then, do you know the numbers for sheltered? Because and that just means that they're in someplace like the Salvation Army. They have stayed the night there or
sure. Mm-hmm. And that number has decreased a little bit since last year. This year, we showed 185 homeless that were in some sort of shelter. And in 2013, last year, there was 228.
I know that there was, maybe 9 months ago or so, there was some action to remove homeless people from their camp by the river.
That's correct.
Did that follow through? And
well, Richard Griffin, who owns the property right south of the camp, the North Camp, he went ahead and let the people move onto his property. But just recently, they've been given notice that they had to vacate that property due to the walking trail that the city is getting ready to put in, and they are right on that trail. So they have been asked to move again, and they were given 30 days notice.
Because of things like this, do the questions that you ask the people that you talk to, do they vary from year to year?
No, they're pretty much the same questions. We asked them where they slept last night. We asked them how often they've been homeless. Have they just recently been homeless? Have they been homeless for, one to two times in the past year, three to four times? So we asked them that so we know the consistency of, if they're chronically homeless or not. We don't ask them any personal questions other than we ask them if they use illegal drugs. And we ask them if they are needing help for depression, We ask them if they are needing treatment for alcohol, you know, just chronic conditions that they might have. So we just try to find that out, and then we publish it. We ask them if they're veterans, so we know that statistic also.
With those questions being said, are there any numbers that really, really stood out to you this year? Is the majority chronically homeless? Is the majority veterans?
No, the majority is not veterans. We have about, I think, 16% that are veterans, which is still way too high if you are to categorize people. But, you know, most of the people that are unsheltered don't seek shelter for a particular reason. You know, obviously they're cold, but the shelters seem to have some barriers that they can't cope with at this time. And those are like having a pet. A lot of them have pets, and none of the shelters will let you bring in a pet. So at our new Riverview Hope campus, we are going to allow pets, and we'll be providing kennels for the pets, where the people are still going to be responsible for taking care of them, but they'll know that they're safe while they're resting. Let's see, what's another barrier? They have a lot of possessions, and that's all their possessions. You know, they don't want to be leaving their things because they're afraid they're going to be stolen. And so we will be having secured storage area where they'll all get like a big Rubbermaid tub and be able to put their things in there, and they'll be able to gain access through a safety officer that will be there anytime they need anything out of their tub, and they don't have to worry about people pilfering through their things.
Well, you're one step closer to this campus becoming a realization.
We definitely are a lot closer, and that's why we've started already recruiting volunteers, and we're getting ready to start a capital campaign. We're also hoping for a large gift to come through the beginning of April, which we'll, you know, put out a press release on if it comes through. We've got more and more people that we're speaking to. Every week we do talks at different organizations, and most of our comments are very positive. One of the things we've seen across the nation is that there's about an 85 to 95% success rate in getting people out of homelessness when you actually use the campus model, because all of the services are right there, and they're not missing doctor's appointments, and they're not forgetting to take their medication and things like that. That's all going to be within our control to help them do those things.
And the response from the homeless community, has there been a response from the homeless community about
yeah,
the campus?
Well, when we did our point in time count, we told them, you know, that we were going to be opening up the campus soon. And in some instances, we asked them if they would be interested in getting off the street and coming out there, and most of the answers were yes. And, you know, we definitely understand that we are not going to get every single person off the streets. But it's just amazing how they were living. And it is a big change for them to come.
Debbie Everly is the director of homeless programs for the Old Fort Homeless Coalition. The coalition released their 2014 point-in-time homeless count last week. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Saturday morning, the Northwest Arkansas Clinical Pastoral Education Institute will host a free interactive grief seminar at the Jones Center in Springdale. The seminar is titled Parents Left Behind, Rebuilding Your Life After the Death of Your Child. The keynote speaker is Dr. Susan Averett, a local pediatrician and bereaved mother. Last week, Dr. Averett stopped by Studio 123 to discuss the seminar, which, in addition to her keynote address, will feature four different breakout sessions.
One of the breakout sessions addresses kind of the early phases of grief. It's called Navigating Life, and that's going to be put on by the staff at Circle of Life Hospice. And so they'll be talking about just general grief, what's normal, what's abnormal, when to seek help, what can you expect in the first stages of grief and as you go along your grief journey. And then the second breakout session it's called Grieving Partners, and it really addresses the different ways that people grieve and how difficult it can be when two people are grieving together, not just husband and wife, but that's kind of what it's targeted towards. But there may be, different types of partners that are grieving together, but trying to celebrate and acknowledge the differences in the way that we grieve so that we can support each other through our grief journey. And then there's somebody coming down from the bereavement center at Children's Hospital to talk about grieving families. And one of the things that I wanted to really push for and that I feel like I need some help with is your children and how they grieve in the process of having lost a sibling. And then the other one is called forgiveness. And that's kind of a global topic of, trying to work through the resentment and the anger that becomes part of your grief journey and trying to figure out which part of the anger to hold on to, which part of the anger to let go of, and whether or not that anger is targeted at a person or at yourself or at God. And so that's kind of a little bit more of a faith-based, philosophical forgiveness area in the bereavement journey.
And as you mentioned, you'll be doing the keynote address. Can you tell me a little bit about the topics that you're going to be discussing or what you'll be sharing with the audience?
Well, I'm going to start off by talking about my story as a bereaved mom and what happened with my child. And then I'm going to share some of the experiences that I have gone through over the last 8 years since my daughter died. One of the things that I've done a lot of in the process of traveling through my grief journey is I've written a lot of poems. So I'm going to share some of my poems. And I think the poems that I'm going to pick target those areas that go into these breakout sessions so that I can kind of plant a seed for thought in as I'm talking as to what area each person might want to consider going to on the breakout sessions. So I'm sharing some personal stories, some of my poems, and then I'm trying to be a little bit clinical too as a healthcare provider and kind of touch on the health aspects of grief and what's normal and when to be concerned so that we can make sure we identify people who may need extra help and people can kind of reflect on themselves and see whether they feel like they're at a place where their grief is kind of the normal healthy process of grief or whether it's getting outside the norm. So we can make sure that people don't, go down a path that can be destructive or harmful. And then just really celebrate kind of the similarities and the differences that we go through along our grief journeys and hopefully provide some inspiration to people in the fact that I have kind of progressed and now I'm able to come to the point where I can be at a good place to share my story and to maybe bring some hope and healing to other people.
Would you like to share a little bit of that story with us?
When my daughter was five, her name was Cameron, and she was in kindergarten, and I was taking her to school, and we lived in a small town in Oklahoma, and we would park across the street from the school and then walk across this crosswalk to get into the school, and one day there was an elderly driver who just failed to stop in the crosswalk and took Cameron's life.
Now, going through that, did you find that there was support for bereaved parents, or did you find it difficult to find that support?
I think that people want to help in whatever way that they can, people who are part of your life and then people who are in the helping fields. But that as a bereaved parent, you have so much pain and you don't really want to have that pain tried to be explained to you by someone who hasn't gone through that. And so I had people reach out to me and try to help me that did the best that they could, but not being bereaved parents themselves might not always say the right thing or might not always have the right angle that we went along. I knew that I needed help in that journey. And I accepted the help that I got with a grain of salt because I knew that the person hadn't been through it. But I also really relished being able to have conversations with and being able to interact with people who had been through the death of a child. And I didn't feel like there was a lot of that available to me. When I moved to Fayetteville about 8 months after Cameron died, I looked for support groups and for organizations that could really help me, and I didn't feel like there were a lot of those out there.
Why do you think that is? Because I feel like I often hear of support groups, say, for someone who has cancer or is, you know, has a loved one who has cancer, or I feel like there's grief perhaps for someone who's elderly who's passed away, but whether that be your grandmother or your wife or whatever, but I don't know that I have heard so much on children.
Right.
Why do you think that that is? Not that they don't exist, just that I don't hear about them as much.
Well, two things. One is that I think they are starting to exist a little bit more in our area, and there are support groups around the country. There's an organization called Compassionate Friends, but we don't really have a chapter of it here in this area. I think that it's a really tough place when you're going through it. At first, you resist reaching out to other people because you feel like your grief is so unique in a way, and it's like all you can do to get through it. And then as you kind of come a little further along and you feel like you need more support, then it's just not there. And I think it's so tough for people to reach out and go down that road at first, that it just, the energy that it takes to put something like that together, you just don't have it. Your energy is focused on just trying to survive day to day. So it almost has to be somebody that's been down the road a little ways who comes and says, hey, let's put this together. Because when you're early in the stages of it, you just don't even know how to get out of bed some days. So you can't put the energy into it.
Were you able to eventually find a support group or some sort of grief?
Yes, I attend a group called Grieving Parents Support, and it's out of Rolling Hills Baptist Church in Fayetteville. And that organization, the minister there, his name's Steve Sheely, he developed that program, and he has a special place in his heart for grieving parents. And I think that's what it takes, is somebody who says, this is a ministry that I'm willing to take on. And it started when he had talked to a family within his church who had lost a child and decided to put together this. It's a program called the Worldwide Candlelighting Service. And these services are on the second Sunday of December at 7 o'clock at night. Worldwide. So wherever you have the service, you're supposed to have it at 7 o'clock. And so he had the initial one, I think, about 2007. And then a year or so after he started doing that, and which he has that at his church every year, he started having those families who were coming get together. And that's how the support group started there.
Why is it important, or would you say that it is important for someone to perhaps join a group like this to share their experiences or talk to others who have been in a similar position that they have been in?
We always try to make sure that people know that it's completely for them. And so you don't need to feel like you have to come. But if you feel like you need to come, we want to have that support group available. And it's kind of evolved. We initially just kind of sat around the table and talked. But now we try to have some direction, because one thing that I've noticed, and I'm a little further out on my grief journey than some people, is that I don't really find any benefit from rehashing the past as much as I want to find a way to discuss our commonalities and work through the problems that we're having so that we can maybe evolve from them. Because it's more important for me not to kind of wallow in what I can't fix, but move forward along the grief journey. And in moving forward along the grief journey, you have to evaluate internally what's going on and then acknowledge the manifestations of the grief so you can then move forward with them.
What would you say one of the biggest challenges is for you now at the point in which you are right now during your grief journey? Because I'm sure it's different for everyone depending on where you are.
Yes, it is different for everyone. And I think one of the things for me is that the loss of my child was so traumatic that I still have difficulty just celebrating and remembering the times that we had together in a positive way. That, for me, is one of the hardest parts of my grief journey, because I can take my energies and work towards my own personal survival and my own personal life, but it's difficult for me to be happy about the memories I have with Cameron, because there's so much pain associated with them.
In one of the breakout sessions you mentioned, it addresses the family, and yes, you had mentioned your children.
Uh-huh.
How many children do you have?
I have three living children. I have three daughters.
And how has that been for you to sort of explain what happened to your other daughter?
I've always tried to be very honest about what happened and not tell any lies or sugarcoat anything, because I feel like it's not fair to the kids to kind of grow up with a misconception about what happened. But also, I don't want that to define who they are. And it's been different for each of my children, because when Cameron died at the age of 5, she was the oldest. So I had a 4-year-old, and then I had a 1-year-old. And a year after Cameron died is when I had my last child. So their experience as siblings was different for each of them, and is different for each of them, because of their relationship with Cameron was different. And for me, the one that I focused the most on is the one that was 4, because the two of them were only 14 months apart. And so they were very close in age. And with Kennedy being younger than Cameron, that's all she ever knew. And so as I watch her grow and evolve through the years, I see how the loss of her sister affects her development in different stages. And it's been fascinating for me. It's also been sad. But I'm very proud of the accomplishments that she has made throughout her life, despite her perspective being so different than that of so many children. But she's had some issues with fears of things that I don't think that would have been there had she not been through that horrific experience. And when I notice that she is not handling her transitions well and not handling her emotions or, you know, fears, what have you, then I've gone and gotten counseling for her at different stages, and it's been very helpful. And she lets me know when she's done. Okay, Mom, I've had enough of that counseling. I'm good. And then over the next few months after the counseling, I'll see her blossom, you know. But because she is going through these normal developmental stages, that changes with her age and with what she's going through emotionally and cognitively as she grows and learns more about the world.
Why would you encourage someone to come to this grief seminar, and what do you hope that participants will take away from it?
I would encourage people to come because sometimes you don't realize what you need until it's presented to you. And so when people are going through their grief journey, whether it's been a month or whether it's been 15 years, they can benefit from this seminar, because it's going to validate them in terms of what they've felt or what they're feeling, and it's going to make them realize that they're not alone. And then it will educate them about some things that they may not have considered for themselves. It will help them to have the opportunity to network and meet other bereaved parents. And then at the end, it will give them an opportunity to remember their child and to say to themselves and to the world, my child was special. My child mattered. I still love my child. I will always love my child. I remember my child. And this is a very important part of who I am today and who I always will be.
That was Dr. Susan Averett, the keynote speaker at a grief seminar being hosted by the Northwest Arkansas Clinical Pastoral Education Institute this weekend. She stopped by KUAF last week. The free seminar is scheduled from 8 a.m. to noon Saturday at the Jones Center in Springdale. Participants can register online at nwacpe.org.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs. Casey Bill Weldon is one of the forgotten men of the commercial development of the blues. William Weldon was born July 10, 1909, in Pine Bluff, Arkansas.
As my baby woke me one morning, at a clock well second four.
Weldon was a member of the influential Memphis Jug Band and recorded with that group in 1927 before recording solo in the mid-1930s. The March 1935 song heard here, called As the Clock Struck Four, also features P.D. Wheatstraw of Cotton Plant in Woodruff County on piano. In 1936, Weldon recorded I'm Gonna Move to the Outskirts of Town. The song's form is age-old 12-bar blues, but addressed modern times with its references to getting a refrigerator to replace the Iceman. In November 1941, Brinkley, Arkansas-born R&B pioneer Louis Jordan also had his first real hit with this song. Jordan biographer John Chilton said the song really launched Louis Jordan as a major recording star.
I'm gonna move way out on the outskirts of town. I'm gonna move way out on the outskirts of town. I don't want nobody, ooh, always hanging around.
In fact, Louis Jordan's version of fellow Arkansasian Casey Bill Weldon's song, I'm Gonna Move to the Outskirts of Town, was such a success for Jordan, he recorded his own answer song in 1942 with new lyrics, but still sharing royalties with Weldon. It was called I'm Gonna Leave You on the Outskirts of Town.
I cut out my Iceman, I bought me a Frigidaire. Now you're letting the serviceman take you everywhere. I'm gonna leave you, baby, right out here on the outskirts of town.
Louis Jordan and the Timpani Five also had a big hit with a third Casey Bill Weldon song called Somebody Done Changed the Lock on My Door. Jordan recorded it in 1945. Others like Wynonie Harris and Tar Heel Slim would follow. Weldon's version was originally cut in October 1935.
Well, well, she changed her bed around. She even changed her stove. She changed the carpet on the floor. But that change that hurt me, she changed that lock on that door. Because the key I got, woo, well, well, won't fit that lock no more.
Casey Bill Weldon's varied talents on guitar have caused some music researchers to suggest he is more than one person. Some also say he was married to blues woman Memphis Minnie, who is known to rock and roll fans as author of Led Zeppelin's When the Levee Breaks. Weldon appeared as a sideman with Memphis Minnie and as a member of the Hokum Boys and the Washboard Rhythm Kings, also featuring Washboard Sam of Walnut Ridge, Arkansas. Here's the Washboard Rhythm Kings from November 1935, with Please Come On Down to My House, with Arkansasers Washboard Sam and Casey Bill Weldon.
Please come down to my house, baby. Nobody home but me. I've been watching you my dream of days. You look good to me. Papa going to buy you a Coca-Cola and you let me play one piece on your graph-graph-nola. Please come down to my house, please. Nobody home but me, I say. Nobody home but me.
Information on the life of Casey Bill Weldon is shadowy, but his contributions to the blues are not. The Pine Bluff native is featured on more than 100 recordings as a solo artist, on influential bands, and as a sideman for the likes of Memphis Minnie. Weldon's skills as a lyricist have kept several of his songs alive as blues standards, even as the name Casey Bill Weldon fades. Now, with Black Bob on piano, here in its entirety is Casey Bill Weldon's Blues Everywhere I Go, recorded in April 1936.
Thank you.
blues got a left this town, so it's blues. Blues everywhere I go. Well, I'm gonna find my good gal, so I won't be blue no more. Well, but it's blues in my room. I don't know right from wrong. Because the blues in my kitchen, my biscuit roller's gone, so it's blues. Blues everywhere I go. Well, well, I'm gonna find my good gal. Well, well, I won't be blue no more. Well, well, it's blues in my mailbox, 'cause I can't get no mail. And it's blues in my bread box, 'cause my bread is done got stale. So it's blues, blues everywhere I go. Well, well, I'm gonna find my good gal. Well, well, I won't be blue no more. Well, well, so it's blues in my meal bell, and it's blues on my shelf, and it's blues in my bed, because I'm sleeping by myself. So it's blues, blues everywhere I go. Well, well, I'm gonna find my good gal. Well, well, I won't be blue no more.
Jefferson County native Casey Bill Weldon with Blues Everywhere I Go from April 1936. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. For more information, visit arkansongs.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. Our history doctor, Bill Smith, may have been absent from our show for a few months, but that hasn't kept him from keeping track of how the press and the general public discuss history. He couldn't help but notice the conversations about noted leaker Edward Snowden have missed some parallels between current concerns over the NSA and episodes from the United States past. He told Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums that spying and telling citizens about secrets involved with spying is nothing new.
Well, you really don't have to look much further than the nonfiction bestseller rack to see that our country was founded by one of the great spy masters, George Washington.
Yes.
Because his colonial-era intelligence network was key to the Revolution. I could give you, though, two very direct examples of the "there's nothing new today," each one of them just about a century old.
Just before World War I, then?
Well, indeed. Actually, right after World War I.
Okay.
So just
okay.
about a
okay.
century old. There is something to be considered about the consequential effort of code breaking, for example, in the Zimmermann Note.
Germany, Mexico, U.S., right, all in there?
Exactly. The Imperial German government had proposed an alliance with Mexico if the U.S. joined the Allies during the First World War. Because remember, we were neutral in thought as well as deed under
right.
Woodrow Wilson until after his election or his re-election in 1916. So in return for opening up a southern front on the United States, Germany would assist Mexico in regaining its lost lands of the Southwest dating back to the Mexican War of 1845. So
Texas, New Mexico.
California.
Exactly.
The German embassy in Washington, D.C. would receive this coded telegram and then forward it on to the ambassador in Mexico City. The message was sent on January 16th, 1917.
January 16th, 1917, and decoded or broken sometime thereafter?
Utilizing their code-breaking team and an interception point in the transatlantic cable known as Room 40.
Room 40.
Yeah, some of these things begin to sound a little bit like modern day. The British had all the provocation they needed now to shift American public opinion, because by the next day, they had decoded enough of this message to know exactly what it was.
By the next day.
By the next day. However, here's the problem. If we reveal the cable, we reveal Room 40's existence.
And you don't want to do that.
No. So initially, there was an elaborate cover to try to involve bribing the Mexican telegraph operator that would have ultimately received this coded message to gain a copy from Mexico City and bring it forward so that they could say, hey, look what we found in Mexico City, not that, hey, guess what we had listened into
right
on the way to Mexico. So it took a month for the British to assemble what they needed to try to make their play. The other part was they had to convince the Americans that this wasn't elaborate propaganda. So you had to also have a certain amount of proof. So whether or not a forgery was part of this plot, you know, the American ambassador was shown a month later in Britain what the Crown knew. And initially he said, well, this can't be true, you know, disbelieved it. Shown both ends of the traffic, though, he eventually relays the findings to President Wilson, who released the message to the newspapers on February 28th. So see the amount of time it took for it to be revealed. Now, of course, that's going to cause, as you might expect, quite a furor in the public. In the end, Germany's Foreign Secretary, Arthur Zimmermann,
right,
of whom the note is known for, admitted to the diplomatic effort in the very first week of March, so we go to war from there.
I was going to say, January it's sent, February it's admitted, you know, public, March then the admission, April.
April we joined the Allies, and it wasn't the direct impact. I mean, what really gets us going is unrestricted submarine warfare resumption by the Germans at that time with the Unterseeboots, the original U-boats. But this was no small part of changing America's public opinion.
Sure. Here's an effort to get Mexico to declare war on your southern border. That would tend to start to shift public opinion, I would think.
Yes, it would, and it did.
But it was the British that intercepted this in Room 40.
That's correct.
Okay, but there's an American involved here?
Well, indeed. The Americans learned from the British, and during the course of the war, and especially at the end of the war, there was the desire to try to start our own code-breaking practice, to start our own listening in on telephone and telegraph. And under the guidance of Herbert Yardley, the Cipher Bureau was established in the State Department.
I'm sorry, but that sounds like something I would have come up with when I was like 10, the Cipher Bureau, but go ahead.
Exactly. This is the immediate post-First World War era and a world focused on disarmament. The new president, Warren G. Harding, would bring the superpowers of the day to Washington to discuss reducing the nuclear weapon of the day, naval battleships. Hmm. So if you're hosting that conference, you'd like to know how far you could push the other side in the negotiations, and there's nothing better than being able to read the other side's diplomatic traffic. So
right,
Yardley's team had broken the Japanese diplomatic code. The Japanese were keen to bring their navy up to par with Great Britain and the United States, but in, you know, arms limitations, we want to keep the Japanese Imperial Navy at a lower level. Yardley's folks were able to tell U.S. negotiators that the arms reduction Japan would accept was a ratio called 5-5-3. U.S. gets 5 battleships, Great Britain gets 5 battleships, Japanese only gets 3.
So if you know what your opponents are willing to do, you'll drive them to that.
It's just like knowing the exact price of the wholesale on that car when you
right
walk onto the lot. You've got an advantage in the negotiation, and that's exactly the deal that the Washington Naval Conference produced.
So Yardley is the grandfather of the NSA?
Hardly.
Okay. I like to make those connections.
One of the great ironies that relates to today, telegraph companies became less and less willing to give up their diplomatic cables to Yardley's group.
Well,
because then their clients overseas were knowing that the Americans were spying on them. Soon, Henry L. Stimson would be named the Secretary of State for Herbert Hoover.
Mm-hmm.
As he comes in, he discovers some of the things that are going on in the State Department, becomes aware of the Cipher Bureau, and famously declares, "Gentlemen, do not read each other's mail." He cuts funding in 1929, and the Cipher Bureau is done. Yardley is unemployed, just in time for the stock market crash. So code breaking went back to the military.
Out of the civilian realm.
Out of the civilian realm. And nothing that approached the previous level that even had been established sort of with Yardley's work. It's not until the Second World War that the U.S. revived and expanded its code work. By the way, something the British had never abandoned.
Yardley, what happened to him?
Well, publishing wasn't quite the same back then, or maybe it was, as it is today. 2 years after Stimson successfully shut down Yardley and the Cipher Bureau, he came out with his own book, The American Black Chamber. And this is how many people really know the Cipher Bureau, is by this sensational label that Yardley gave it through his book. He revealed many of the secrets, the assets, the names of workers, the techniques, and
it became
a worldwide bestseller, notably in Japan.
Oh, my gosh.
The government wanted to prosecute him, but technically he had broken no law because revealing these secrets was not covered by anything. It was such a new art at the time. Now, that gets corrected with a 1933 amendment to the Espionage Act to cover code work done by anyone that had worked for the federal government. Of course, the greatest irony of all in this, when Stimson, serving as the Secretary of War under Franklin Roosevelt,
right,
he was not in a position to read what the Japanese diplomatic traffic would be in November of 1941, leaving us with a great speculative what if.
What if a cable about Pearl Harbor had been read?
Exactly. Mm. But I have one more small footnote to this.
Oh, you love your... Okay. Okay, I'm ready.
I'm not sure what is more creepy in this.
Mm-hmm.
In the course of doing the research for today's script, I found some documents that were related to the Zimmerman's note, including a 10-page declassified article from Cryptologic Quarterly.
Okay.
Or the fact that where I found it was in the public documents of the NSA's website, where they have put Herbert Yardley into the Codebreakers Hall of Fame.
Seriously.
Seriously.
So, wait a few decades and let's see what happens.
Exactly.
All right. Well, until the NSA reveals your email password.
We're history.
Bill Smith earned his PhD in history from the University of Arkansas, and his examinations of history are a frequent feature of Ozarks at Large.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, why is it so hard to say no?
It's really a fundamental need to maintain our relationships. We don't want to reject people. We don't want people to, you know, think poorly of us.
But what's the cost of always saying yes? That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now coming up next here on KUAF. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Prairie Grove. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. I will be back along with my co-host, Kyle Kellums. Thanks again for listening, and I hope your week is off to a fantastic start.